Okay, we're going to call the committee to order. This is the Wednesday, March 18th, 2015 hearing of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Members, we are going to hear from the executive branch. We're going to hear from the commissioner of the Department of Transportation, and the chair of the Metropolitan Council to understand what the governor would propose we do on transportation matters. And then we'll take a look at Senate proposal, Senate File 87. Members, we're going to do a walkthrough of that, respond to some questions, and then put it on the table, and then come back on Friday for purposes of testimony and markup. With that, I see the commissioner and the chair are shaking hands. That's a good sign. They are friends. That's always best. And we'll invite, are you both going to come to the table at the same time? All right, however you want. All right, very good. However you want to handle your presentation. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to go through fairly briskly the overview of the governor's proposal from the MnDOT perspective, and then I'm happy to take questions, or we can have Chair Dunnock do that and answer questions, whatever you'd like.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
The real boss in the room was talking. Why don't I go through this presentation fairly quickly and then answer questions after that, if that would be most convenient.
All right.
Okay. I'm going to kind of go over a lot of material, most of which I think your committee is very familiar with. So I won't try to belabor it, but rest assured, I have been making this presentation in one form or another across the state of Minnesota most recently, and then have appeared a couple of snippets before your committee at some of those locations. So I appreciate that opportunity. And the more we can bring facts to the table, we appreciate the opportunity. But of course, we're at this what I call the perfect storm. One of which is that our system is deteriorating. 50% of our pavements over 50 years old. The extreme conditions, and we're just entering into pothole season. So I'm sure we'll have even more good examples of that very soon. That happy at the same time that there's an increased use of our system, the road and bridge system in particular, and with new population coming in. And I was just in New Ulm yesterday, and to kind of give you a flavor of greater Minnesota, there's a great, robust economic story to the state of Minnesota. And but along with that, greater needs of our transportation system. And again, it is multimodal. It's not just highways and bridges. It is from river traffic to transit to bike and ped. And when I'm in New Ulm, it is clear from talking to the chambers to the city council, to the mayors, they care as much about the truck and freight access as they do about the livability of their main streets. So it's a balance of all those factors. I've often asked, what happens if we don't have any increased funding to transportation? And we've gotten more specific on this question over the past 6 weeks. You'll know from some of the work that I'll be, some of the analysis that I'll get into here in a minute, that we'll have an increase, a fairly dramatic increase in the the poor road condition throughout the state. Clearly, congestion will and reliability of drive times will worsen. And you know, the problem with these 50% of our pavements over 50 years old is that concrete erodes from the bottom up, asphalt erodes from the top down. So what you see on many of our highways literally is the tip of the iceberg. And I think everybody has a story about potholes, but what they don't often see is the substructure of many of our roadways, that need more than just a refurbishment. And that's why part of the reason we're committing as much to a comprehensive program. So the funding scenarios really led by the analysis done at the original Transportation Finance Advisory Committee puts the funding levels at various categories. And we all remember that in the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, this kind of maintenance mode is, although TFAC outlined a 20-year plan, the maintenance mode would imply a $2.5 billion budget to maintain the system in its current state. And often the question I get is, in our next 10 proposal, we're attributing $4 billion to preserving and modernizing the current system. And that's because when we modernize, we don't ever replace a bridge with the same kind of technology, the same kind of performance as the bridge that we're replacing. Lafayette Bridge is a perfect example right near here where we're actually replacing that bridge with two bridges. They're 100-year bridges, not 50-year bridges, and they provide for redundancy from a safety point of view, but also flexibility from a design concept that we can do maintenance, serious preservation in the decades ahead by closing one side and putting the traffic on one, which is what we're currently doing, and even allowing for greater expansion in the future if we'd like. So when we think about modernizing, it isn't the same as this maintaining it in its current state. The economically competitive, which is what the governor is proposing, is a $6 billion investment over 10 years in the state highway system. And we have outlined that very specifically in the map. And as you know, we've been traveling the state many times with the governor or the lieutenant governor to outline what the pavements, the bridges, and some of the strategic expansions in the Corridors of Commerce projects. One of the we were often, I think, sometimes criticized that we weren't being very specific about what new funding would allow. Now we are getting criticized for being overly specific about what new funding would allow. So just to clarify that these are not earmarks. We are not recommending any of these projects as part of legislation, but they are the best thinking of our engineers and our planners based upon our asset models, based upon our bridge inspections, based upon our experience and history with maintaining these important assets. As you see in some of the little red marks, because we have already worked on projects as part of the Corridors of Commerce, we are highlighting completing those because they've already been part of our Corridors of Commerce vision. There's additional funding both in the greater Minnesota and in the metro for increased strategic expansions. We have not been highlighted with specific projects, but I have often looked to projects such as the interchange at 494 and 35 as the most likely candidate because of it's such a well-known bottleneck, although it is not specifically highlighted. It certainly fits into that metro mobility category. We put a lot of dots on the map because Main Street projects are a perfect example of how we work with local governments to not only rebuild and refurbish state highways, but to work with pedestrian and bike and livability factors that is part of MnDOT's greater vision and very meaningful, we know, toward local governments. So, again, the next 10 strategy is not just a TFAC analysis. It is really an operational plan, which is an indicator of what we would then deploy as part of our normal planning and engineering process with, again, these large categories. Some of the aspects that were not, again, part of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee is factors of an operational plan. Where would the money go? Roadside infrastructure and facilities were not part of a TFAC study, but they are really necessary investments. So we are now 2 years later, and under our kind of much more pragmatic, efficient point of view, we are highlighting project investments that would really be comprehensive, and that what it would really take to be this competitive system over the next 10 years. Again, this is all additional work that is otherwise not possible without additional resources. If we look at the number, I often get the question, how do you get to $6 billion? It is with the two or three major sources of funding. It is not all from new fees. It is, much as we discussed at the Senate, the 6.5% gross receipts tax with a floor that's a slightly higher floor, that $2.50. It is augmented by the registration fees and $2 billion of bonding. That, if you add that all up, it still doesn't get to $6 billion. That's where we have committed MnDOT's own efficiencies of 15% of new revenues. That really brings that to the full $6 billion for just the state system. Outcome, as we discussed, would be significant. That does not include the additional $2.3 billion that would be available for counties and cities and townships under the CASA formula. Just a note, which we put on the slide, we have not updated these numbers with the most recent forecast. I have looked at the numbers, and I think it's safe to say that these numbers are very close. So I think in terms of understanding the system, you can really count on these same numbers. The revenues have tweaked up a bit, but it's, for this purpose, pretty close. And I think that most people understand that the excise tax on gross receipts is at the same place that the current gas tax is imposed. So there really is no difference in the method of collection. And because the concept would adjust only every 12 months and really be converted to a cent per gallon tax, it would function identically to the current fuels tax and would not be an administrative burden. It would work very well with the commercial fleets and the IFTA process. And it is one that has worked well in the other 12 states who have deployed this method. And I've always seen it from a business perspective, that this is a fourth funding element that helped diversify the portfolio of revenues for MnDOT. And it may make sense to have at least one element have some of the characteristics of the costs that MnDOT has. Fuels does drive some of our costs, asphalt, fuels for the fleets, and much construction costs do rise or fall with the cost of energy. So it'd be kind of like your 401k. You have a kind of a diversified portfolio. This is just one piece, not the only piece. But it would help mitigate the issue with our fixed gas tax system, where we're having diminishing sources of funds because of fuel efficiency. Of course, this is a multimodal vision for the governor, and I know Chair Dunnock will talk about the metropolitan area, but there is a transit need throughout the state of Minnesota. We have all but two counties have transit systems, and the governor's proposal includes $120 million of additional funds over the 10-year period for Greater Minnesota Transit. And we know that MnDOT has been working closely to try to integrate a lot of those transit systems so they work more efficiently and become self-supporting. We know with our aging Minnesotans and new millennials that there's a greater call for transit. And this amount in investment would bring us to about 90% of what we expect and what we've measured as the need. We're considerably below that now. $75 million for bike and pedestrian is most of that is safe routes to schools, but it also is with strategic investments. And I have to say, over 10 years, this is not a lot of money. Most of the bike and ped investments are coming at local county levels and part of MnDOT trunk highway funds. So this is really there for, particularly for areas where we can't use trunk highway funds. General fund purposes are really helpful to help kind of integrate some of our vision at a statewide level. So when I look at the next 2 years appropriation, that's the 10-year outlook. The next 2 years, it is an additional $732 million for the trunk highway fund. And that is, most of it is for the actual construction budget, but $49 million to offset increased costs due to inflation. That includes really 1.8% increases in compensation. Most is, of course, increased costs of our operations, like the cost of salt, commodities, general increases. Of that balance, $200 million we are asking be appropriated from the fund itself, the unappropriated portion of the highway fund. That is what we have also forecasted as a source for the whole 10-year period. Specifically for this biennium, the Greater Minnesota Transit would be $10 million base increase. We forecast that amount would increase in the out years. But for this period, given our current cash balance, that we think $10 million is appropriate. And again, that would be $2.5 million for the bike and ped, and then also something new, an increase from the general fund of $1.4 million for rail activities. This would be to actually establish our own rail office. We have a lot of rail activity, but it is part of our general freight office within MnDOT, which includes a bulk of it is a lot of a highway compliance and ports. But given the whole new reality we're living with in this state of rail congestion, the need for significant investments in grade crossings and grade safety, that we think we need the attention of our own rail office. So it would be taking that expertise within the freight division and really moving it over. We'd be searching for a division director with expertise in rail to augment the expertise we already have and help us be better positioned to be a state partner with some of the initiatives we are working on with all railroads and some of the governor's goals and the legislative goals we've discussed to increase safety and some of our planning activities, some of our oversight, and kind of bring this rail industry, help bring our state government interaction toward the rail industry up to the next level. This is just all the investments in a glance. Often I get the question from stakeholders when we talk that I hear $6 billion, I hear $8 billion, I hear $11 billion. How does that all fit together? So here it is on one page, that the overall governor's proposal is $11 billion. Chair Dunnock will talk about the $2.8 billion of the Twin Cities transit build-out. Of course, there's a Greater Minnesota component, but just to be clear about where the what's a state and what's the state system and what's going to the counties and townships, it's easier to see in one page. Again, this is the forecast estimate over the next two bienniums and highlights where the additional distributions would go over this next biennium, given the governor's proposal for the new revenue. Roughly the $200 million and $300 million as these fees are ramped up. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this one page, which is really the last page. There's a lot of material here, but and I'm just going to highlight, not on every one, but on some very specific items, if you, which I'll call out. I know it's kind of hard to read, but if you have your printed out page, you can see it. Many of these are change items, and there's some embedded policy recommendations that we have that the governor has made, and I'll just highlight on a few. The airports appropriation, the $11 million, is the remaining fund balance that was originally $15 million, but it was this was the last of the borrowings that came back. Most of it was from the school system, but as you remember, during the periods of deficit, funds were borrowed, and there was the last piece was borrowed from the our Department of Aviation. We want to reappropriate these funds because we are able to address some significant capital needs of some of our 135 airports, and we think that we could deploy those in some construction pavement projects, some maintenance projects around the state, and put them to good use. There's a roughly $10 million proposed for two, I say new to us, probably. I hate to say word used, but not new. King airplanes. Our current fleet includes two, which are great airplanes, but one's 33 years old and one's 21 years old. Actually, the 21-year-old plane is in worse shape than the 33-year-old plane, and it really comes down to maintenance costs. And we're approaching some engine replacements, which are very expensive. And although I don't know much about airplanes, I know what it's like when the lines cross on a bus. I think it's very similar. When you spend more money trying to fix it up and having maintain the safety and the reliability, it becomes more cost-effective to redeploy in new aircraft. We are suggesting a fee rental basis, not just recover our actual operating costs, but to operate a fully allocated cost and to create a reserve. So as these planes are used by agencies, that will actually develop a sinking fund so we don't so we'll actually be able to repurchase planes or rebuild engines so we don't have to kind of go for, you know, make a case for this kind of capital investment each time. So we'll really, in other words, be able to kind of track the full capital cost along with the operating costs along the way, which we think is a more efficient and effective way of managing these assets that don't last forever. I mentioned the land conveyance funding. It doesn't show a dollar amount, but the policy proposal here was to actually manage the real estate that MnDOT owns in a more kind of cost-effective way. We know we have excess land, and that these land and these assets could be better deployed by either selling or in some way utilizing them, getting them on the tax rolls. It'd be better for communities. And our proposal is to be able to take some of the funds that we receive from selling land and be able to kind of establish a real estate office. We just don't have the capacity or the time. Our MnDOT is very good at purchasing property. We don't manage them. I manage these assets in a way that we that would be more effective for the state by this concept would I think be able to kind of make better sense out of all the excess land holdings that could be a benefit for the state and communities. We'll touch briefly on the snow and ice contingency. This concept is to actually create reserves. So in winters like this winter, we'd actually not have to. We'd actually be able to not call on a reserve because the funds aren't necessary. But you got a winter like last winter. I have been told when I first came to MnDOT, when I asked, "What happens when you spend all of our operations money on salt and ice and plowing overtime?" And the answer is we do less culvert maintenance, sign repairs, cable median barrier repairs. In other words, we pay for it from deferring maintenance during the summer. And much of the work we do for the summer is planned, you know, 4 weeks ago before you really know what the whether winter's really over. So it's a very inefficient process. And I've said, gee, there's no way to run a business. Why don't we just create what arborists do, which is let's create a reserve, because you think about snow and ice goes up and down, and in this proposal would be a way just to kind of make sure we're not losing out on doing proper maintenance at times that that I think that's as necessary as anything. And I think we have these reserves really in place with the trunk highway fund, which is dedicated MnDOT funds anyway. So it's not asking for additional general fund appropriations. It's just part of our efficient management of state funds, highway funds. Touch on the flood appropriation is really extending an appropriation that was already made for J. Cook Park. We really want to make sure that this beautiful little scenic byway that goes through a wonderful area along the St. Louis River in Duluth, and we did a lot of surveys with stakeholders in that area, and they really very much wanted to see that continue as a state highway. As much as I offered to rename it Landauer Drive, DNR had no interest in taking it, and so we're recommending we finish the job, make it beautiful, but to that we need to extend. Work is nearly completed. We need to extend the appropriation. And again, then we have a rail safety administration, which I discussed earlier. So that is a lot, and as you see, any questions? I'd love it if you would actually ask Tracy, who is with me, my chief financial officer, who probably knows more about any of the numbers than I do, but I'm happy to take questions along with Tracy.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, members? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, you indicated that there was $1.4 million for rail a rail program that we would be transferring people. Is that actually a transfer or is a transfer of FTEs? Are there new FTEs resulting from the new office? Can you explain more information or can you give me more information about are we adding more FTEs as a result of that $1.4 million you're proposing?
We would be adding some FTEs, but not a significant number. We would be out looking for a new rail director. So we will be posting that soon, but there would be some of the personnel would be you'd be people that we know we have in place, and then funds to help support some of the new positions. We can get specific, give you the specific answers if you'd like. If in fact we're marching toward a much larger investment. Like some of the grade crossing, initiatives. When we, as a result of our study, for a 10-year period, there's as many as 15 grade crossings. You know, if we start really amping, increasing the role of this office, then there might be additional resources required. But this is not considered a robust office, but as one that we think could be better suited to respond to kind of the rail world that we're living in now, as opposed to a number of years ago when it was really about kind of ultimately it was federal railway inspectors. Now the state is taking on a bigger role.
And Rosman.
Mr. Chair, and a follow-up to that, and going over your entire budget or your overall budget request here, do you have an estimate on the number of new FTEs that would be created by the entire package that you presented today?
That I will defer to.
Commissioner.
You want to come? Do you know that answer?
Welcome, Ms. Hatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number that's coming off the top of my head, and we'll be happy to get a detailed breakdown, is that we would be, with the Next 10 package, about 292 employees total, growth over 4 years. So as we kind of ramp up to be able to deliver the projects as well as respond to asset management needs, we would have some employees in the operations and maintenance area and some employees in the program planning and delivery area. But over the 4 years, for an investment of the size that the governor has requested, we have estimated about 292 employees total.
Additional employees.
Additional FTEs. And I might also just add that the current base budget does not actually support all of the FTEs we currently have. So the number that you see in the budget document, there's also 500, if memory's correct, it's like 527 FTEs department-wide that we currently don't have funding for. And so that's exactly why we've asked for the 3%, the 1.8% increase to support staff costs, and then which is probably less than what the full need might be when you consider health care and other things. And then about 1.2%, as the commissioner mentioned, for offsetting other inflationary costs, salt, bituminous commodities primarily.
Senator Osmak.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, so what you just said then is that what you want, given a perfect world, would be over 500 FTEs, but this proposal is 492 FTEs. Is that what I heard?
Ms. Hatch.
Madam Chair, Senator, actually we would basically plan the workload based on the current complement we have today, which would require us to essentially buy back those 527 FTEs that we currently don't have funded in the base, and then we would need a 292 on top of that.
Okay, Madam Chair, so Senator then the Osmak. Number is actually closer to 800 FTEs from today over the next 4 years.
Ms. Hatch.
Madam Chair, Senator, the number's actually about 292 higher than today. But so, for example, on June 30th, through June 30th, we can afford the current staff we have. And it's not 5,000. It's south of 5,000. But just for ease of discussion, let me just say 5,000. It's in the neighborhood of 4,700 and something. But let's just say it's 5,000. I can afford these 5,000 employees through June 30th. As of July 1st, I can no longer afford all 5,000. So if you want, if the question is how many additional above the 5,000 mark, which is a lower number, it's 292 above that.
Okay.
Thank you. And Ms. Hatch, if you can pull the microphone a little closer to you. Thank you. And Senator Osmak.
One additional question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you, Commissioner Zelli, you defined that we had two state aircraft, and you're looking at replacing those aircraft. One of those aircraft then would be the governor's aircraft. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have a number of aircraft, smaller aircraft. These are the King Airs, which are used for multiple agencies and the University of Minnesota. And so they're slightly different seating configurations. One's slightly larger than the other. But they're both used by multiple agencies, including the governor's office. So he uses either one, but right, it is those two.
And one follow-up.
Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These planes you said were bought many, many years ago, up to 30 years ago, where we probably in Minnesota didn't have as robust air travel system that we currently have, with daily commercial flights available to Brainerd and all other points in the state. Wouldn't it make sense now that we have a more robust system that we discontinue these types of aircraft and just use commercial, which over the long run may be significantly less expensive, not only from the purchase, but ongoing maintenance? As you have found out over 30 years, they turn into very expensive pieces of equipment that you eventually have to replace. Wouldn't it make more financial sense to have them fly commercial?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe we've had a study that kind of looked into a variety of travel costs and through different modes, like commercial or driving, or but it's my understanding, out of 135 airports across the state, we do have some limited commercial aircraft, but only two, I think it's four or five. And St. Cloud, of course, now as we're talking about it, actually being reduced, so it really wouldn't touch as many points as the commercial aircraft goes to.
Senator Peterson, and then Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Zelli, and we just heard testimony. I think that's what I heard. I thought, to follow up on Senator Osmak's line of questioning, that I thought that you said that there's about 500 positions that are vacant right now. Was that accurate? No, you just don't have the funding to get them through past June. Okay, And then can you give us a sense right now, agency-wide, within the Department of Transportation, how many reserve funds you have approximately, and then what the dollar amount that might be in the reserve funds? Do you have that?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator, one point of clarification. The numbers that I referred to was for the 4 years. So that's over the four-year period. The example I used was effectively we can afford those employees through June 30th. The actual number drop-off for the 1 year of 2016 is 311. But we can provide a breakdown of that in detail. It is in the budget book, but it's a little harder to see. But we have that. We'd be happy to provide that so it's clear. But over the 4 years, we would need to hire an additional 292 employees to complete the package. In terms of the reserve funds, I might need a point of clarification. Do you mean like reserve funds that were already appropriated to us, or are you talking about our fund balance, the reserve fund balance?
Well, yeah, really both. I guess that's the question I'm getting right now is that, and I can take that from you another time if you don't have that available, but you know, there's a sense or a belief that that the Department of Transportation has significant reserve funds, and whether that's true or not, that's what I'm trying to identify, I guess.
Ms. Hatch, Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator, before our CFO, Deputy Commissioner Hatch, gives you the actual answer, it is my impression, often looking at cash balances, to ask how much of these are already encumbered, and we have significant amount that has been encumbered for future project expenditures. So I think whereas it's true, MnDOT has some cash balances, often it depends on the time of year or where in the stage of a project we're in. So it really is helpful, I think, to maybe even, and I would invite anybody to sit down with Deputy Commissioner Hatch and kind of go through over a period of time where the use of cash versus, where the true reserve is, because I was shocked to see the reserve amount less than it would appear by looking at one snapshot.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would also just comment that I'll address the fund balance in just a moment, but the commissioner is exactly right that it depends on whether you're looking at the cash balance or the balance of cash sort of in the checkbook as compared to the budgetary fund balance or the budgetary statement. So if we have a project, for example, a large construction project, we encumber those funds at the beginning of the project, and those funds are obviously not all out the door at the beginning of the project. In terms of operating dollars, funds that might exist, we do set aside at my direction an amount of about $5 million. Sometimes it's for the year and sometimes it's for the biennium, depending on what we see as potential risks in our near future. Often those end up being things like significant litigation that comes up that we have to address. Sometimes there are things like the roof on a truck station blew off during a storm, actually during the shutdown. Sometimes there are things that are unforeseen for which we just feel like, given the size and complexity of the agency and the amount of budget that we have overall, the responsibility that we have, it's a minimal amount. It's a significant amount of money, but it's insignificant from an accounting standpoint in terms of $5,000 compared to the $3 billion we're responsible for.
Senator Pierce.
So, Mr. Chair, if I heard you right, then an unencumbered reserve is about $5 million.
Okay. Deputy Commissioner Hatch.
The risk reserve, if you will, that we withhold to make operating decisions on that come up is $5 million. And I think this last biennium, we reserved $5 million a year. But I'd be happy to provide additional detail in terms of what the specific numbers are that are spent, encumbered, allocated, not allocated. And the fund statement that just was released recently at the beginning of March shows an unreserved fund balance for 2016 of $158 million. And so those are funds that are not yet appropriated to us.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Reinert and then Senator Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, just to build off Senator Osmick, but maybe to take a little different tack on it, I do think that the department having at least a couple planes in its inventory is a smart thing. I think it's an efficient way to move our high-value employees around the state, and it also gets you and the governor and others into these smaller airports that would otherwise not be seen. My request, and I brought this up in front of this committee before, is as you look at replacing that inventory, I'd really encourage the department to have an RFP that allows for a Minnesota-built plane, Cirrus, if I'll be direct, to at least be able to compete in that process.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further, members? All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. My question is, when I was listening to the FTEs, and I just wanted to clarify it, so there are 500 FTEs that are funded through up to July 1st, and then after that you don't have funding. I kind of did a quick calculation of those 500 times an $80,000 package, more or less thereabout per FTE. That came out to about $40 million a year. And so where would that... I was looking for a change item. Is there a change item for $80 million for that, for those 500 FTEs plus? No?
Deputy Commissioner Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is not a specific change item. There is a request in the next 10 package, as the Commissioner showed on a couple of different slides, that there is an additional request to offset the increase in salaries. So that request is about 1.8%. I can direct you to exactly the slide if I can find my copy. And so it's essentially 1.8% to offset salaries. Thank you. Slide 13. And 1.2% is built into that to offset other inflationary costs. So again, the 500 employees is over the 4 years. So in order to kind of maintain the current complement that we have, over the inflationary period of 4 years, it totals up to something that equals 500, and I think it's 527 FTEs over the 4 years. As I mentioned, of the 527 FTEs, I believe it's 311 that is the actual drop between the current biennium and next biennium. And so this funding that we've asked for here would help us to maintain those employees. Some of those FTEs, those are full-time equivalents, so they're not. It's not headcount, it's FTEs. So some of those positions are, some of those FTEs may be temporary, seasonal, you know, part-time, not, you know, fully benefited employees. So it's the gamut. It's just it's basically a calculation of the FTEs that we typically use in a year and what we've used this year, and then what the salary budgets and the current funding will afford in 16 at the base level. So can I just make one other comment? So as an example, in the current biennium that we're finishing, so 14 and 15, staff received a 3% increase in 2014 and a 3% salary increase in 2015. And then there were some healthcare costs on top of that. The total of that, the impact to our budget for the 2 years for that was a little bit north of $45 million. So they are significant dollars.
Okay, so now I'm getting a bit better sense of that. So the additional costs for the pay raises and so on are basically taking what you would otherwise, if things were flat, exactly, be able to have to maintain those employees. And then that there's not a specific line item for that it's just included in the percent increase overall. Okay, and you mentioned a few of those. What else? That's a lot of employees, although out of 5,000, that's about 10%. So. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned seasonal and part-time. What are some of the other bigger chunks that might be? What do they do?
Mm. Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can get you a more specific breakdown. I don't have it with me, but some of the positions are, you know, when we do snow plowing, it's just the first thing that comes to mind, but we employ a lot of temporary and seasonal employees during snow plow time, including 45-day employees, where we only call them in and use them when we're needing plow service that we can't manage. We have some students, we have, and some of those are spread throughout the agency, student or student intern kind of workers. Some of those are, you know, full-time employees that we have in the department. And so...
Well, if we, no, why don't you do that? Just follow up with that, and it's too much detail for today, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, I'm curious, and I have been ever since I heard the initial proposal, about this idea of a wholesale gas tax, and why, since the advent of the just cents per gallon gas tax, which I think has served us well and is certainly perceptibly evident to consumers if they want to know. It's pretty easy to understand. But why in, for instance, 2015 are we talking about a different kind of gas tax in addition to the, of course, the per gallon? Why wouldn't we just stay the course and just do the 16 cents if that was a good idea?
Senator Senjum, it hasn't served us that well. That's the point. But, Commissioner, well,
Mr. Chair, I want to find out why.
Yeah. Senator,
I'm glad they're handling it, because then you don't have to ask me when I bring my proposal
up. Well, Mr. Chair, I may ask anyway.
I know I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, just briefly, I think that it introduces a fourth stream of revenue that will go up or down with our costs, and over time, because the gas tax, fuel tax, has been fixed on a per gallon basis, as people have driven less and the cars are more efficient, we certainly are getting less revenue from that source. Uh-huh. But also, the gradual cost of inflation with not just fuels on our fleet, but asphalt, cost of construction, that the per gallon does not keep up. So it does have a indexing kind of quality to it, that it would go up or down based upon what is a major cost factor within our department. And we know that other states have introduced this kind of mechanism as part of their mix. It retains the dedication to the highway trunk fund, and it is collected at the same time and as easily as part of the overall fuel tax. So it's very efficient in terms of collecting and measuring. And because it adjusts once a year, converted to a traditional fuel tax, it is really just additive to the fuel tax. But it has a, it just does have a different kind of pricing. So over 10 years, had the current fuel tax had this kind of mechanism, we probably wouldn't be looking at the shortfalls and gaps that we're currently experiencing.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
You mentioned other states have, I'm not sure, implemented or at least looked at it. Have other states implemented the wholesale gas tax?
We believe there's as many as 12 states. Okay. And I know South Dakota, I just heard yesterday, has introduced a new funding mechanisms, a gas straight gas tax, and this indexing feature, this tax on gross receipts. So I think more states that are having user fee charges are actually going to this because it seems to mitigate one of the risks that this purchasing power problem with fuel taxes had in the past. So it's again, I think it's our belief that it is not the answer by itself, but it certainly helps considering all the other streams to be more of a 10-year solution as opposed to having to go back every 4 years to try to figure it out.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just shift gears a little bit, and maybe you did cover it, maybe I just missed it, but I'm trying to kind of understand the $6 billion, and I go back to your initial comment about 671 miles currently, and I think in terms of the million-dollar mile thing, so it's $671 million, or call it $700. If we did the $6 billion figure, is it simple mathematics? I mean, I don't think you counted bridges and things like that, which are probably more costly than certainly $1 million a mile. Where does that $6 billion take us in terms of overall road improvements, probably measured in how many miles or how many bridges? Do you have any idea? And maybe it's on there and I just didn't catch it.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, we're trying to be very specific with what we believe our best thinking and asset models and bridge inspection forecasts will indicate. And we have identified 600 bridges and 2,200 miles of pavement. That is the largest element, but there's other elements of that $6 billion funding that would be able to be deployed, including strategic expansion in both greater Minnesota and in the metro area, such as expanding some of the MinPass transitway areas. And then some of the pavement reconstructions that we're facing, and we often talked about I-94 just between the Minneapolis and St. Paul, that project is significant enough and yet not part of our current planning because there are just enough resources. And clearly that project would be a lot more expensive per mile than reconstructing some of the pavements we have in greater Minnesota. So each project has its own cost characteristic, and we've certainly actually have summarized that now on a per project basis. We're happy to share that list. Now there's a great range because we haven't done the planning or the costing or the engineering of each one, but we feel that these list of projects give a pretty good idea, illustration of what could be accomplished, and very specific because we know the condition of the pavements. But it isn't a specific costed out plan per mile. That is, it's not at that point, and it wouldn't be until we put it through our normal, very, very comprehensive process.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sundrum.
Thank you for bearing with me. By my standards, there are certain areas, at least my standards, of course, are southern Minnesota, but there are certain areas up in the Twin Cities that are, from a congestion point of view, awful. Whether it's the I-94-35 intersection over here in Minneapolis or wherever, but where will you do this? Are there certain places like that that have been identified that might be improved?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. I think we've certainly done a lot of analysis, and we think it is more than just traffic speed and congestion. There's safety. There's just movement of traffic. We think of freight corridors, very important, for instance, and Highway 14 is very much about a corridor of commerce. It's classic because it includes the capacity to handle great freight movements to those businesses in that area. So it's not so we have that corridor of commerce has other criteria than just how fast cars go. But when you look at that I-35-494 interchange, it is a bottleneck, not just for the metro area. We hear about it from shippers in Wilmer and the southern part of the state who go through the metro on the way to East Coast markets, and they're driving right through that same bottleneck. So we try to look at these needs comprehensively, and we could tell both to preserve the system we have, and the way I've kind of described it, which is oversimplifying it, but if the needle toward deterioration has been moving this direction, we could just want it to start moving in the positive direction. And with this funding, we have identified ways to gradually improve the condition of the roads and stay ahead of it so they're not deteriorating. And we know that our efficiencies will come in part because the undercapitalized roads are going to become more expensive to repair later. So if we are to refurbish roads at the right time and then ultimately replace roads and bridges at the right time, over many decades, we will save the state money. So part of it is the practice. It is a 10-year snapshot, but it doesn't stop at 10 years. We really have a 50-year vision toward what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Senator Westrum, then Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, back to Senator Sinjum's question on the gas tax and the change to the gross receipts tax. I guess I didn't follow or hear necessarily a reason of why the traditional gas tax isn't working, where the wholesale receipts tax would pick up the difference. And just my observations, but if you could respond maybe to what I heard or what I missed. You've got a gas tax. The gross receipts tax is going to fluctuate, which oftentimes is worse than if you've got a stable source of consumption. And granted, purchase of gas can go up or down, quantities can go up or down throughout the years, that can fluctuate. But if prices go down and a sales tax is on it, it's going to be less revenue. And if they go up, it's going to be more. It's interesting in the proposal that there's a floor put in at $2.50, which under current prices would actually be higher than what we're paying at the pump, fortunately, and much higher than two, three months ago. But I guess I wasn't clear on what isn't working under the gas tax that people more commonly can conceive of. So many cents per gallon, which is what we've done. I didn't understand what the real benefit was going to be,
Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Wistrom, I think the concept is to have a element of in a new source of revenue that would have a different characteristic than the straight per gallon tax. It had the per gallon tax had a feature where it would rise with the cost of fuels. 10 years ago, we would have had considerably more funding available to meet the increased needs of our roadway system over the past 10 years. And we know the reason I said one element, not all four, should have an indexing, because it makes sense to me that you have part of our funding go up or down with the costs that we incur at MnDOT that also goes up and down. If fuel prices go down, then the cost of asphalt would go down. So it's that kind of makes sense from a business perspective. We have 800 trucks that plow snow around the state. Well, if diesel fuel is down, then I think that not for the entire source of MnDOT's revenue, but for one aspect. So it is kind of a diversified portfolio of funding. This could go up as fuel prices go up. And down, I think, we're comfortable because many of our costs would go down. The floor is because there is a basic underfunding of our infrastructure system. It's undercapitalized. And the floor is really the need that goes beyond just our costs that go up and down. We just know there's a gap. So we recognize that floor really makes sense for the, call it 15 cents a gallon. You know, 15 cents a gallon, if you look at that level of funding, it translates on average to a motorist to about, including the registration fees, of about $15 a month on average driving. So if it goes up to, if gas prices go up to $4 a gallon, MnDOT costs go up, but for a motorist, maybe it goes up another $4 a month. So we don't think that those fees for using the system are out of line with the general cost of what it takes to operate a car, which is significantly more than that, but it is fair user fee for being part of this system. And given that there's tremendous cost to individuals, the hidden tax that we see is the damage that's caused to people's cars, the cost of being stuck in traffic, and the safety risks that we all bear by driving in an adequately funded system. And so the $15 a month is, we feel, a good investment because collectively it produces $6 billion of value that everybody enjoys. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wistrom.
Does that generate the full $6 billion that you're looking to achieve?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually it provides a good portion, roughly, let's see if I got the right slide. Yeah, it's here. But the combination of the gross receipts tax, the registration fee increases, provide the revenue, then additional $2 billion of bonds could be issued because with we would not be exceeding the debt policy limit of using 20% of our state funds toward debt service. And then that and those three sources don't bring us all the way to $6 billion. We would be able to commit up to another $650 million of MnDOT delivering these projects more efficiently because of that revenue. So we think a combination of all four, grocery receipts tax, registration fees, new bonding, borrowing, and our own efficiencies add up to $6 billion.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, in response to Senator Sunjum's question about gas taxes and how the revenue and the actual inbound money we get from the gas tax is decreasing, but there is one area, or actually two areas, of MnDOT's inbound streams that is increasing and is indexed to inflation that I think a lot of people don't recognize. Your November 14 forecast from the Minnesota Department of Transportation indicated in the next biennium, if we don't do anything, we're going to see almost a quarter of a billion dollars worth of new revenue. This is revenue that was not projected in the details. This is money that we were not originally planning on seeing at all. So in reality, we do have other mechanisms, and you would agree with it to be a true statement that we have a static granted for the gas tax, but now the registration fees and motor vehicle sales taxes are actually going to combined exceed what we get from revenue inbound from gas taxes going forward. Is that not correct? I just want to make sure that I'm reading right here your forecast correctly.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm going to let Tracy give the specific numbers, but it is true the motor vehicle sales tax and the registration fees are, in a sense, indexed. They do respond over time with inflation, and I think that's what we've seen. The fuel tax is actually 49%, whereas those other two combined are 51%. That wasn't always the case. Fuel tax has been a lesser percentage. Having said that, the idea of having yet a fourth element is one that is not indexed to car prices or general volumes of fleets, but more toward the price of energy, which is the single biggest cost factor. So it is kind of a diversified outlook. It has a different kind of indexing mechanism specifically toward energy costs. Our economic forecasts do contemplate an increased number of car sales, which is really catching up during this recession period. Mm-hmm. We expect that to not only flatten, but actually goes down a little bit and flattens out. So our forecasts have already contemplated most of that revenue, and I'm going to look to Tracy, but I think we've actually, that the variance that we've seen isn't so much variance as to what we've actually already included in our forecast to achieve that $6 billion number. And but you're right, as our construction costs go up and as our other needs react to inflation, part of that has already been addressed by those two mechanisms. But there, we are kind of in a period of a little bit of a car purchase bubble, and my car dealer friends can give more substance behind that, but I don't know if I missed anything.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, I just wanted to make a point of clarification. The actual growth in the fund over the last forecast is only $14 million. The growth in actual dollars compared to the current biennium is the $260 million that was referred to as the quarter of a billion. So the only unplanned revenue listed there is about $14
million. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the simple fact of the matter is that the next biennium, we're going to see $240 or $260 million in that budget period above the previous budget period. So one other comment to Commissioner Zelli. While you may say that this is a bubble, and we've seen lots of different bubbles, housing bubbles and things like that, the truth of the matter is car prices continue to go up. The 1987 Chevette that I bought was $5,000, and I just had to replace my daughter, my SUV, because my daughter totaled it. That was about $24,000. So, you know, we will probably see more increases, or we may even see the electric cars become more popular. I know Representative Garofalo has a Tesla, and those are not coming off at $24,000. So you will agree that as we continue to move forward in the next decades, we would anticipate revenue just going up, not just because of a bubble, but also because of increasing gas or increasing vehicle costs.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, yeah, you're right, and the bubble I'm speaking to isn't the bubble of that nature, like a tech bubble or housing. It's just that we have considered those forecasts in our economic analysis. And but just to answer the cost, yes, there is general increases in car prices, but we used to build bridges for $20 million, and now we're looking at $200 million. And they just don't give away miles of concrete like they used to. You know.
Sir Nosbick, my first car was a Chevette, too.
We have that in common, yeah. Mr. Chair. Right. I did not know that.
So many things.
Our first names are also David, too, so we got two things.
All right.
And I have Tesla envy, too.
So the capital is full of possibilities. Who do I see? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Zelli, I was trying to go through the document a little bit, but it's just fresh off the wire here. So quick question. Mentioning electric vehicles, natural gas, okay, we saw natural gas, CNG or UNG, well, that's the sticker, but anyway, is in the governor's budget proposal then, since they use our roads, bridges, and so on, is revenue included or proposal included to capture their use as well, financially?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, actually we've done an analysis of the Chevy Volt versus the Chevy Cruze over 5 years. They're essentially the same car, but one's electric. And the revenue, simply because of the Senator Osmick's point, because of the motor vehicle sales tax and the registration fees on the Volt are greater than the Chevy Cruze, including the first 5 years of gas tax increase. So Chevy Volt actually contributes more to the Highway Trunk Fund than the Chevy Cruze for the first 5 years, simply because of the point that those other sources are very important.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, so does a Lexus, and we don't make a difference because when it may be a more valuable car at the beginning and certainly do that, but the amount of consumption of gas or fuel resources are still taxed. So I don't consider that a part of a factor to be considered so that we don't take some sort of revenue from them in regards to the fuel side of the equation, because certainly the core cost of a car changes, but it's the gas consumption, whether it's a Lexus or a little Honda Civic that gets 40 miles to the gallon. So, but I think the big thing is that what I'm hearing, though, is that no, there is no additional consideration, because you want to talk about trajectory. I think some of these electric cars, the hybrids, and the natural gas, and some of these things, we ought to certainly be taking a look at those vehicles and on just a simple, you know, fuel basis consumption, whatever that may be source, whether it's electric or natural gas or gas, they should be in the mix as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you have no argument for me. I think that as this category of vehicles starts to expand in our road use, that is something that we should consider over time. And maybe a mileage-based program, maybe. Who knows when that is, but I mean, we've been part of a group consortium of states that are studying it. Oregon's actually experimenting it with a demonstration program. So I think there's a lot of thinking about ways to deploy user fees, gas tax, registration fee, motor vehicle sales tax are not perfect, but I certainly think it's worthy of analysis. I think it is such a small part of the market now that over time it's worth exploring, and I think the idea of actually having dedicated funds is important. I can't read the notes. My deputy.
Would Ms. Hatch like to talk?
What does that, Ms. Hatch, read her own writing?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm very sorry. They are currently taxed. Those other fuel sources that compressed natural gas and so forth, those are currently taxed now. I'll have to double check to just make sure that this is or is not the gross receipts tax would or would not impact that, but those sources are taxed today.
I was stuck on electricity.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll consider that maybe an amendment to come forward here as we take a look at this bill to have some sort of placeholder mechanism that we can include that. Thank you.
All right. Anything further? We'd like to get to Metro Transit presentation. Are we ready for that, committee? All right. Chair Dunnick, welcome. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Good afternoon, and rest of the Transportation Committee. It's great to be here. I wanted to just say a quick word, which is today is a Transit Driver Appreciation Day in our region, which is an exciting day. I was just at lunch at the Haywood Garage with a number of our operators, and if you see a transit operator today, thank them for their service. They do a great job for us. I have a presentation today to walk through and certainly answer some questions on. I want to talk a little bit about the transit system as we know it today, talk a little bit about the challenges we face in this region, and explore and expand upon what the governor's proposal is.
And, Chair, if you could just introduce yourself formally for the record.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for the reminder, Mr. Chair. I'm Adam Dunnick, the chair of the Metropolitan Council. So, as we like to remind people, transit connects us, and talk a little bit about what the purpose of our transit system is. Nearly 40% of the people who work in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul take transit every day to get there. 80% of the rides are to either work or school, so we're trying to connect people directly to opportunity. And three-fourths, around 75% of our transit rides are taken on the bus service, even though there's certainly other modes that we operate as well. And the other point I think is important to remember is that two-thirds of our riders have an automobile and are choice riders. So we serve sort of two distinct audiences, people who are riders by choice, but also transit dependable riders as well. On any given day, there are 331,000 rides on transit. And just this past year, we got close to the $100 million rider mark in the region. And certainly in 2015, we'll be poised to eclipse 100 million rides. Another point that Commissioner Zelli made, which I'll just reiterate, which is kind of the future market for transit. We have a strong market here in this region, and we know that there's been growing demand. Every year, the younger generation certainly has made that clear nationally as well as here locally. Our base bus system continues to grow in its demand, and people are deciding where they want to live first and then where they want to work and what career path they're going to pursue, which is an important part of planning our system for the long run. Transit also eases congestion. As you can see here, the bus on the shoulder, we're out on the intersection of 494 and 35W a couple weeks ago, and in that corridor alone, over 14,000 people every day take transit. It makes up a little over 7 or 8% of the riders and the commuters on that corridor, even though the buses themselves only make up less than 1% of the vehicles on the road. So what we're talking about here is trying to be more efficient with our infrastructure and move people around more efficiently. Another thing we like to talk to some groups about, it depends on your perspective, but transit stimulates growth, and the business community has taken the lead in making this point. The Itasca Group a number of years ago put out a study. It's a little bit dated now, but the result is, I believe, still been borne out and certainly been shown in the Green Line, which is for every dollar we invest in our transit system, we're able to then maximize that investment by attracting additional private development. The Green Line alone, we've seen nearly $3 billion in development. And the Blue Line, we've seen additional housing units going up as well. And it's something that this region has continued to get better at as we do our corridor planning, working with the cities, working with the county to maximize their planning so that these investments are worth the cost. The other thing we like to remind people of is that transit gives consumers choices. This is about choices, having the systems work well together. Again, I'll dovetail a little bit with Commissioner Zelli here. We need the road system and the road network, which, again, our buses travel on, so that system matters a whole lot to us as well, to work well with the transit system. We also have a very successful park and ride program, so another slide in a slide or two here we'll touch on some of that. But different corridors and different parts of the regions have different needs, and then therefore the service that we provide to them, we try to customize to the diversity of those needs. It's a slide that shows some of the park and ride facilities in one part of our region. Where we don't have density, we've tried to do a good job of creating it by having a successful park and ride system. We provide over 19,000 individual park and ride users system-wide on a daily basis. Next, we have some images here to show you a little bit what the vehicle types look like, what the typical subsidy is, and the passengers per hour. The system, obviously, again, looks different everywhere you go. But we keep very close track of the fare recovery and what the subsidies are, and then what we do every couple years, the regional service improvement plan to try to improve our service. Where we don't need it, we cut it back. Where we're seeing more demand, we're trying to add service to that part of the region as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, could I ask what fare recovery means? 26% of what?
Sure.
Chair Dunnick.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator. The 26% shows that the fare that is paid, so the $1.75 in the non-peak and $2.25 in the peak, covers that percentage of what the cost of the ride is. So if the fare recovery is 26%, then the fare that's paid is, you know, again, that amount would be times four, essentially. It'd be the cost of the ride.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing as we're on this slide and Senator Senjum brought it up, you're indicating a subsidy of only $1.56 for light rail. That does not include the actual amortized costs of the build-out of the entire facilities required to provide that light rail service, correct?
Chair Dunn.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'd have to check with our staff on that. It could just be based on that's true. You're right, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that they're shaking their heads because they know I know the number. So, Mr. Dunnick, wouldn't it be more accurate to describe the subsidy amortizing out approximately at a 30-year rate more closely to $6.56 versus $1.56, that the actual amortized costs, and of course you can check it with your staff, are significantly double the cost of local bus service and express service. Wouldn't that be a fair statement, assuming my $5 is correct and I'm very careful about watching those numbers?
Sure.
Chair.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that's right, yeah.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dunnick, to fare recovery, how often do you guys look at rates on your fares?
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I believe it's every 2 years. The regional service improvement plan is done, so it's every 2 years.
And, Mr. Chair, when's the last time you adjusted your rate schedule?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's the last time we changed fares was 2008, October 2008.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. So it's been 7 years since you've done anything on fares. And yet we've been hearing about increasing costs and why haven't fares kept up with inflation, so to speak?
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, thanks for the question. We've looked pretty closely at it. We've had a work group looking at it for the last couple of years, and we have a couple of recommendations. We haven't moved anything forward yet because we are anxious to see how this proposal will play out. But I anticipate that we will move on a fare proposal within the next year. Some of the ideas we've been talking about are raising the off-peak from 175 to 2 and potentially lowering the peak to from 225 to 2, so having it be somewhat of a neutralizer, but I think ultimately it would actually raise more fares. We have to look at the numbers, so we'll see what it really does. But it's my long way of saying we've looked at this over the last couple of years, and we plan to probably, I assume we'll act in the next year or two, but it's, we, you know, we wanted to see how this legislative proposal would play itself out as well.
Chair Dunnick.
Next, I wanted to show a quick clip, and I'll see if I can get this to work. I'm not sure if it will. I'm just going to... Not going to get the technical issue to work here. Do you want to get this to work, John, by chance? What we did was we tried to capture a live shot of our bus route. Okay, there we go. Thank you. This is just, you know, there's constantly questions that I get and that we get at Metro Transit about the half-empty bus or the mostly empty bus. But what we really wanted to show people was that on any given route, people are getting off, people are getting on, people are getting off, people are getting on, and there's still, again, our basic bus service is very productive, does really well. You know, again, at times the bus is going to be full, and at times the bus is going to be a little bit empty. But you could make the similar remark about other infrastructure that is being used at certain times and in certain places and not used as much in others. And so we like to remind people that even though the bus isn't always full, certainly the service has been well in demand. And depending on the corridor you're looking at, oftentimes it's standing room only, or it's possible to get a seat during rush hour, and even sometimes during the off-peak. I've certainly been on a number of buses and light rail vehicles myself where that's the case. Another way we think about fare box recovery is to take a look at some of our peer regions, and so we've been monitoring this pretty closely. We look at this annually and frequently to see how we compare with other regions. And again, I think Metro Transit has a pretty good record here of doing very well in the fare box recovery. A couple of the other important challenges going forward, our region is going to grow. We know that from the work that we've done at the council. We anticipate an additional 800,000 people here in the next 25 years. And in order for to accommodate that growth and move people around effectively and efficiently, again, this is why we think building out the transit system both on the capital side to expand the system as well as in the operating side to improve the basic bus service we provide. We've seen, you know, thanks to the leadership of the legislature in 2008 and CTIB, the County's Transit Improvement Board, good investments and significant investments on the capital side in some of our systems, but what we haven't seen over those same past 7 or 8 years has been an investment in our base bus service, even though, again, we'll continue to see that population growth and the demand growth. Another challenge, kind of talking about the funding sources, we've relied to build on some of what Commissioner Zelli said, the motor vehicle sales tax funding and general funds, which have been at times very unpredictable. And so, again, from a planning perspective, for us to think about what our needs are, which the next slide will touch on a little bit, it's hard for us to plan and to grow out the system in a way that we need to year in and year out rather than waiting till the last day of session sometimes to figure out whether we're going to have to cut bus service or raise fares or look at some of those options. We've seen the motor vehicle sales tax funds drop. We've seen the aging bus fleet that we have, the shelters and facilities, the capital needs that we have at Metro Transit. And the other significant cost driver is Metro Mobility, which is federally required for us to provide. And we've seen those increase of costs in the neighborhood of 10, 12, and 15% year in and year out. So to talk a little bit about what the governor's proposal is, it's a half a cent percent sales tax, which will raise $2.8 billion over the next 10 years in the 7-county metro area. When phased in, it will be approximately $256 million a year in fiscal year 2017. And what is the $2.8 billion, what does it get us? It gets us a modernized transit system using some of the new technologies and real-time updates. Some people might say this is a little bit of what you'd call the extras or something that the service doesn't really need. But for us, it's really thinking about the customer demands and what the expectations are in this region to provide a level of service that is reliable and dependable in the four seasons that we have here. And we're also looking at how we can take advantage of newer technologies, real-time information being one, better signage, better access to help grow the system as well. These types of things are becoming the standard, frankly. And when you think about regional competitiveness, we're trying to have a transit system that is high quality as you would expect in other big cities and big regions across the country. What else does the $2.8 billion get you? It gets us an additional 30% in increased bus service. So, again, the basic bus service, which we have not seen grow over the last 10 years or so, we'd be able to keep up with the inflationary growth and the demand. We'd have more routes, more frequency in service, and more coverage. And some of the routes in which we are currently providing service, like the arterial BRT service that we are looking at doing, we'd be able to take the service we have there and make it more efficient and make it more cost-effective. Another slide about, again, talking about our peer regions and trying to remain regionally competitive. This shows clearly that some of the other regions that we're competing for business retention, job growth, employees, and to attract new families to our region and keep the ones that we have here, these are what some of the other regions are doing to invest in their transit system and grow out their basic bus and transitway development that they're doing. Furthermore, we're also competing with these folks for the FTA dollars, which is a very competitive process right now. There are 7 projects around the country that are in the Federal Transit Administration's funding queue, and we're one of them with Southwest LRT. And we have very strong projects here in the region that can compete from a ridership standpoint, from a economic development standpoint, from the standpoints that the FTA is looking at. But what we oftentimes lack is that local match, that local funds. So this next map we like to show is the current system today. What I like to think about this is these are the types of routes where if you walk out your door in the morning or if you go to a park and ride to catch one of these routes, you're able to go to a transit stop, and even if you just miss a light rail vehicle or a bus, one will be there in 5 or 10 minutes. And the frequency of service is really what's important, and certainly that's been the routes that we've been able to build over the last couple of years, the last 10 years or so, going back to Hiawatha LRT, have helped us put us on the map in terms of having a stronger transit system. But what we really want to build is this system. And to get there, to both have the capital resources to build the system as well as have the operating dollars to run it and improve the connections between the bus lines, that's really what this $2.8 billion investment will get you. And to summarize, we're looking at 20 additional transitways. Transitway projects are these higher frequency services. 16 or 17 of them would be bus. So again, there's some light rail, I think, where it's warranted, where it's needed, where there's the population density and forecasted growth to warrant that kind of service. But I'm a big believer in the bus system. I think that's really the workhorse of the system and where the future is in this region in transit. The other thing that's a little bit different and I think much improved since our proposal 2 years ago is in doing the most recent regional service improvement plan, we've been able to take a look at where we would add service, some of which is express, some of which is local. Some of the service would be new lines where we don't currently have service. Some would be taking service that we have and increasing the frequency. Instead of every hour, there'd be rides every half hour. Instead of every 30 minutes, there'd be rides every 15 or 20 minutes. And Metro Transit has done a significant amount of outreach. This isn't a plan that's been adopted, but what we wanted to do is be in a position to talk about this at the legislature and be ready to act quickly if we're able to secure additional funds. And the kind of summary of what it is we're trying to accomplish here, again, to grow our ridership from around 100 million rides to 170 to 180 million rides by 2040, more frequent service, more hours of service, attracting new residents and jobs, improving bus access to 1 million jobs. And to me, the real key here is giving a regional employers access to an additional 500,000 workers within 30 minutes of a commute. And when we had the chair of the MAC, or excuse me, the executive director of the MAC in front of us a few months ago, or a couple weeks ago now, we asked him, what's the difference between having the blue line in operation today than what the MAC was like as an employer, the airport as an employer 10 years ago, 12 years ago, before the blue line was in operation? And he said, we have access to a workforce that would have never been able to work at the airport. And I think other employers along the line would say the same thing, the Mall of America certainly, and certainly employers in downtown Minneapolis, that then all of a sudden you're able to get to a job in 20 or 30 minutes instead of an hour, hour and a half, or longer, which some riders, as I've met along the way, have told me about their two-hour commutes that they take, you know, multiple transfers and are just trying to get to a job and are having difficult accessing that via our transit system. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer some more questions.
Thank you, Chair Dunnick. Questions, members? Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunnick, good to see you again. Question I have for you is, I'm familiar with fare box recovery on buses. And, you know, the token, the coins, the fare card, you know, a variety of ways. You have a bus driver, you get on the bus. And so from what I've seen, there's a really good fare recovery. You know, it's very predictable and whatever. In regards to light rail, North Star, Blue Line, Green Line, whatever they may be, how do you do – I don't ride them. So how do you do ticket taking, whatever that is, fare recovery? How do you do that on – those light rail lines?
Sure. Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, we on multiple lines, we just have, I mean, we mostly have Metro Transit security checking tickets. So occasionally that happens and occasionally it doesn't. It's spot checking. But it's pre-board fare, so you pay before you get on or swipe your card if you have a go-to card, and then you ride, and then you're cited if you don't have a ticket or haven't paid your fare, but very much is the honor system.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
So, Mr. Chair, so on the buses we have this very specific way, but on the rail it's the honor system. The one time that I did experience a light rail went to a Twins game, and I noticed that. Mm-hmm. We had our ticket and all ready to go. It purchased it off the website. Got on the train, there was nobody, no checking, nothing, came back as well. And in conversations with others, that was common. They hadn't ever been spot check, you know, didn't say spot check, but they had never been. And so that's really bothersome to me, because how can you do a cost-benefit analysis if you don't actually collect the fares that are supposed to be there? And it seems these days with technology, you don't necessarily have to hire people, but you can have that little mechanism sensor that senses when somebody breaks that red line and they're entering on, and you can have, again, the same thing, a credit card these days, debit card. I mean, so many convenient things. I'm just amazed. Wow, these are just being built new. This is not like retrofitting anything. So why would you not do that on these light rails?
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I mean, I'll check with Metro Transit to see if we've looked into any more additional technology. They're usually actually at the cutting edge in a lot of that. I think it's just at this today, it's an expense question of having the security staff to be there as present as possible. I get checked frequently. I do take both bus and light rail quite a bit, and I get checked pretty frequently. So it's I never think it's fair to characterize it as we never check people or we're never there. I think that there is a pretty good presence, and the fines are significant. They're over $100, I believe, so it's not something that I think people do without thinking about it.
So, Chair Dunk, how often, what is the rate at which people are caught violating when you do the checks? And how often, just to give us a sense, how frequently do you check, and what
Mr.
do you
Chair,
find when you check?
If I can just clarify, I didn't say that nobody did. What I said was the people that I had talked with said they had never been. Okay?
Yeah. We've had this conversation in this committee before, so sure. I'm guessing you have those answers.
Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Regional Administrator Pat Bourne. You might have.
Welcome, Mr. Bourne. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Pat Bourne. I'm the Regional Administrator. We have just completed one of our periodic internal audit reviews of fare checking on those transit ways where we are on the honor system. And both our auditors and our Metro Transit police show that on the blue line, the light rail line that runs from downtown Minneapolis to the Mall of America, we're at about 97% fare collection. It's a little bit lower than that on the Green Line. We expect the Green Line passengers to learn how they need to buy their fares and to get checked. So if you're a Metro Transit police officer and you come across a passenger who has not paid their fare, and we find that out in a variety of ways, we take their name, we give them a warning, and we ask them to get off the train at the next stop. If we find them again, a transit police officer finds them again, then we do fine them, and the fines are, as Chair Dunnick said, well in excess of $100. But it does take some time, and it will take some time on the Green Line, our newest line, for our passengers to learn what those fare penalties are and how to buy either a fare card or to buy a to-go card. By the way, the electronic fare card touch card is well over 50% of the riders on the Green Line and well over that on the Blue Line as well. It's a very convenient way to buy your fare. There are people that buy paper tickets, and we have stations at which you can buy paper tickets, but most folks pay with a credit card, buy a card with a stored value on it, and we are seeing an increased number of our passengers and riders who are using the more convenient means of paying for their fare.
And you get a slight discount if you pay in advance. I assume that's to recognize some savings in administrative. And
that's true.
Yeah. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I was still going to go back to that, though, that in these are fairly recent rail cars, and that in its construction or the statement of work for the construction of them, it seems as though that the ability for people to get on and so on, just like you do toll roads. I don't know of anywhere else where you have an honor system and you just depend upon audits, and it comes back to that. So I'm just really surprised, and when I went through this experience, I thought, well, I must be wrong or something, but indeed, so you get into the recovery for expenses. I'm still just really surprised that you can purchase these vehicles and not build that into it in its inception. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. I will just I've ridden a number of transit systems around the country, and even when they have the barriers and the gates, there's still a certain number that jump over or somehow defeat the system. So even with the barriers or the onboard payment, which of course would slow everything down if everyone had to pay onboard, but there's not a perfect system, but your point is well taken, because you can drive past a toll facility at 60 plus miles an hour and it'll deduct. So hopefully we'll move to that, and that'll be a lot easier. So I had Senator Peterson next, but I had a few people pop their hands up. Was it to this point?
Yes.
Senator Peterson, do you mind?
Is
this to this point, too?
I can wait. No.
Okay, great. So Senator Reinert and then Senator Osmond.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to get stuck on this point, but that question's always puzzled me as well, and that the light rail precedes me coming to the legislature. So I'm just wondering if somebody can give us the 2 minute on, obviously a decision was made at some point that was more cost effective, or it was more Minnesota nice, or there was some reason we do that, because the Metro doesn't do it, the L doesn't do it. I think most of us who've used mass transit are used to putting a ticket somewhere and it says, yes, you are good to go.
So, why do we select the system we have? Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair and members, this is purely a business decision. It was made some time ago. It has nothing to do with Minnesota Nice. We like to pride ourselves on everybody being, honor bound and great people here, and of course we are, but pat ourselves on the back until we break our arm. But frankly, it's a it's a very sound business decision for us to both build barriers and to staff collection at all of the stations on all of our light rail stops would be considerably more expensive annually than the additional fares that we would collect. While it is kind of dumbfounding to many of us that as many people buy fares as they do, nevertheless, it is true that that's what happens. This audit that we've just finished does compare the Green Line, where it is today, fairly new line, to the Blue Line at its early inception, and the fare payment result is very similar. There is a learning process that people engage in who are our regular riders on each of these services, and it's pretty painful for people to have to pay a really big fine when they get fined, but if you haven't experienced this, it's pretty painful. It's also very uncomfortable for people to be asked to get off at the next stop. It interrupts their day considerably. If they're going to school or they're going to work, they're going to be late. So there's a fairly quick learning process that takes place if you've been caught. And of course, there's the public witnessing of this when this happens. We don't get out megaphones and do this, but it's pretty clear what's going on. And for those of you who have ridden the Green Line or Blue Line and you haven't watched our police officers board a train, ask people for either their fare cards or their to-go card or, in my case, an employee card, and you get checked and they read it with an electronic reader, and we know when the card was bought and when that to-go card was last charged, it's pretty clear what and how people are doing. And it's like I say, I'm not surprised that folks who are not regular users of the system are flummoxed when they hear things like this, but this really is a very sound business decision that was made, and we continue to think it remains to be a very sound business decision.
Mr. Chair, if I remember correctly, our former colleague John Harrington is in charge of making sure mm-hmm. people ride the train with passes. So if we have concerns, we can.
I just saw him last night.
Call him or text him.
So Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on that point, don't walk away yet.
Mr. Barnes.
If a person has a $100 fine, what is your compliance rate with those individuals actually paying the fine? Furthermore, if they do not pay the fine, what are the continued consequences for not paying the fine?
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't know. But I'm going to guess that the fine collection rate is similar to the fine collection rate on other police issued fines of a similar nature.
Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair, I definitely would like to know from Met Transit, and you might be getting it now, we need to know what is your compliance rate with the fines, because when I get a ticket on the road and I have to pay the fine, I haven't had one lately. They can pull my license. They can do many different things to me. And if you don't pay your fare, they might give you a nasty look. But what are the consequences? And that's what we need to know.
Mr. Chairman, we'll provide an answer for you.
Is this classified a petty misdemeanor? I mean, I suppose eventually you'd get a warrant for your arrest if you fail to pay.
Yeah.
So you'd be subject to arrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it would be nice to know how many of those to the committee know how many of those fines you build up before you actually get to a petty misdemeanor, and then what do we do to them after that? Do we have a who's gal for the claim jumpers that are jumping and not paying? So I will move on from that.
In addition to the next train platform, is you know, maybe one of those
stocks.
Yeah,
stock. That's what I want. One additional question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Osvick.
In the metro, I've never heard that one.
Mr. Chair, and to Chair Dunnick, right now, to build out Southwest Light Rail, there is a 10% state designated portion that has to be funded. Is it your understanding that that 10% state appropriation needs to come from the legislature, or is it your understanding if the legislature during this biennium or the upcoming biennium does not fund that, that you have the authority through Met Council to go around the legislature and provide that additional 10% funding?
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's my understanding, that we have to get the authority from the legislature.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Osmond.
It would be your position that if the legislature does not provide that 10% funding through our legislative intent, that you will not proceed with the Southwest Light Rail until you receive that funding appropriation from the state?
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I guess my staff informs me that we have authority to bond against MBEST revenues. It's not something that we are planning to do today, but that we have that authority. The plan is to finance it through the sales tax.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Osmond,
your intent is not to receive an appropriation for the 10% from the Minnesota State Legislature. Your intent is to use other sources to not follow our legislative intent.
Mr. Chair, and
Senator Osmick, how do you construe legislative intent?
Well, it would be, Mr. Chair, it would be that we actually have an appropriation for the 10% that's a state-required match in order to build Southwest Light Rail. That would be what I would consider legislative intent, not a secondary third funding mechanism that might be going through other sources.
Well, Senator Osmick, that I think what Chair Dunnick articulated is that if the governor's proposal or the Senate proposal prevails, that would change.
So, Mr. Chair, so if the Senate's position does not prevail and there is not language, then there is not 10% available for that funding mechanism, correct? Is that your understanding? Is that the chair's understanding?
No, that's not my understanding. I maybe need to unpack the 10% legislative intent that you're asking about, but we have time for that. But I think the Senate and the governor's position are going to prevail. But if they don't, I understand that, you know, the motor vehicle sales tax is a source against which bonds can be issued via the Metropolitan Council.
So, Mr. Chair, what you're saying is Metropolitan Council, if we don't do it, they will.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
I would say, Mr. Chair, if I could clarify, if you don't do it, we could. And it's a long ways from making that determination.
Are you done, Senator Osmond? Senator Peterson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, to that point, Commissioner Dunnick, so, I mean, another way to ask that question, I guess, is, out of the $2.8 billion you talk about in your presentation, a significant portion of that is the sales tax. So if that were to pass, your intent would be to use that sales tax to fund the state's portion, $120 million, using that sales tax revenue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, yes. And
for right. Yes. Okay.
As the plan, I understand everyone's being really quiet. We need to speak a little more closely into our microphones. I'm right. Guilty, too, just so they can pick it up on TV a little bit better.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Dunnick, I appreciate your comments about the bus system and that kind of being the workhorse. You know, that's a discussion we get into here a lot in terms of trying to take care of the things we've built previously before we kind of move on to other things. And one question, you know, that I know our office has gotten from residents here in the metro area related to the bus system. In fact, I talked to one woman who makes a very compelling case, you know, that we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on light rail, but yet she's standing in the cold and the wind and the rain, you know, in our climate where there are two little kids waiting for a bus and quite frankly needs a bus shelter that's heated and and lit. Can you kind of talk through that process that your organization goes through in evaluating something like the shelters, when we have consumers that are certainly have a need for shelters in particular? And I see, you know, in your plan here, you get plan to build 1,000 more, but, you know, of course, their argument, and I think I agree with them, you know, why have we kind of let that, you know, have we let that slip in exchange for doing, you know, part of the Green Line, which have phenomenally lit and phenomenally warm shelters, quite frankly. Yep.
Chair Dunnick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I appreciate that comment, and hearing from constituents like that, we hear from them as well quite a bit. And what I would say, which isn't the ideal answer, but it's the facts, which are we're limited to what it is we can spend our resources on, as well as CTIB and County Transit Improvement Board, who helped us help facilitate the build out of the transit ways like Green Line, are limited as to where they can spend their resources in. So in terms of what has been, from our standpoint of trying to figure out how do we build the system that we have this plan to do, which is the transit ways and keeping up with the basic needs of the current bus service, some of those dollars, because of either metro mobility demands or because of the transit way demands, have cut into our budget. So then there's not a lot of extra money for shelter amenities, real-time signage, some of those things that I talked about in my presentation. And I'm happy to say that over the last couple of years, we've been able to increase what it is we do spend on shelters and the basic amenities. We've actually both received $3.2 million federal grant, which will help, I think, add around 200 to 300 new shelters, some of which are shelters that don't currently exist, some of which are helping to refurbish shelters that have been damaged or just aging over time. But what we've been facing as a council is questions about whether to cut service for routes or invest in our bus shelters and some of those amenities. So either way, we would hear an outcry if we cut some of our service to have better amenities. Vice versa, if we cut away at the amenities in favor of more bus service, that's been the kind of environment we've been operating in, unfortunately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Yep, and I think I would agree with you. Yeah, she would rather have that service and not have a shelter than not have the service at all. Certainly. So if we run into that, I guess I'm not familiar with your whole organization. Is there an ombudsman, or how do you handle those types of consumer complaints or consumer requests related to specific routes?
Mr. Chair, and
they call my office, Senator Pierce.
Okay. Yeah, some of them call. Some
I'd
of them
be
call
happy.
Just ask Judd. Then I call Judd. Chair Dunnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. Some of them call me, some of them call and email council members, but certainly Metro Transit has a pretty robust customer service department that handles those kinds of inquiries.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Senator Westrum, then Senator Pratt.
Mr. Chair, relating to the green and blue line, do you have some numbers offhand? What are we seeing for ridership on both lines?
Chair.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, the blue line numbers, I'm going to try to recall from memory, they are around 30,000 a day, 28,000 a day.
14 actual is almost
34. Oh, 34, even better than I thought. 34,000 average weekday ridership. That's Green Line. It's Green Line. Do you know,
yep.
The blue line is a little bit lower. The blue line ridership. The blue line ridership is around 31,000 a day, which is, there's been some increase over the last couple of years. It's not been as quick to grow. The green line ridership started around just under 30,000 per day. When school started at the University of Minnesota, we saw a huge increase, and now there were weeks actually during October and November where we averaged over 40,000 riders a day, so they've been significant. The forecasted model, we expected about 27,000 riders a day on Green Line, and we've been exceeding that by roughly around 10,000 riders per day.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair Dunnick, do you have a breakout of what number of those are students versus other public members going to work or going elsewhere?
Chair Dunnick.
Madam Chair and Senator Westrum, I do have that. I get a monthly summary emailed to me, and I think other people on staff do that as well. And I'm trying to recall the number from memory, but I want to say around 30% of the riders on the Green Line on a daily basis are the three University of Minnesota stops, which doesn't capture all of them because certainly some of the U of M students are getting off and on and at Gateway and at Raymond and at some of the other stops as well. But those three university stops, there's no question that when you're looking at it from a graphs perspective, they really jump out at you as being really high ridership stops.
Senator Pratt, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have two questions, Madam Chair. Mr. Dunick, when you look at the transit dedicated sales tax and you do these comparables, are you looking at the tax burden in these comparable cities as well overall, or are you just simply focused on the transit portion?
Chair Dunning.
Madam Chair and Senator, I think we are just looking at the sales tax. For transit.
Right. So Senator the fact that we've got, according to CNN Money, a 9.3% tax burden in Minneapolis, and yet Seattle, which you use as a comp, has a 6.5% sales tax burden. Denver at 7.4, Houston at 6.1. The only one that I could find higher than us is 9.5% in Salt Lake City. Don't you think we should be looking at total tax burden versus just simply making a comparison on one piece? Because we do invest in transit through other means.
Chair Dunning.
Madam Chair and Senator, it's a good point. I don't think that we should look at tax policy in a vacuum, but I also think that the difference is that the dedicated nature of the sales tax is what's allows these other cities to invest in their systems in a different way and have that ongoing funding from an operations and capital standpoint that we just have not had in this region.
Well, I'm not arguing that.
Senator
it's
Pratt.
Just
Senator Pratt.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Mr. and Madam Chair, may I have one more? Mr. Dunick, when you talk about $2.8 billion in development, and I look at your map of all the development along the Green Line, it seems to me you're including in that $2.1 billion, $1 billion for a Viking stadium that's on the existing site. You've got $90 million for the state office building, $35 million for the U of M microbiology building, and it doesn't look like you're taking into account the $80 million in public subsidy that you've given. So how much is the true net private benefit that you would claim when you take out all these public projects? The U of M built, you've got, on your map, you've got a number of U of M housing projects that were getting ready to go in before the Green Line was built.
Chair Dunick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do know for a fact that the Viking Stadium's not counted. Some of those other buildings you may have referenced, maybe, I'm not sure. I'd have to turn to my staff to find out the details of that. I'd be happy to take a look and see what percentage of it is private versus public. I know it's a significant majority is private.
All right. For Osmond. Great. Thank you. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One additional question. On page 9, you talk about an efficient system. You talk about local bus, express, light rail. You don't include the actual information regarding North Star. In subsequent slides, you actually take credit for North Star as in a transit, near transit corridors, which was the map with lots of colors on it eventually. Is there a reason why you didn't include the data on North Star?
Chair Dunick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, there's no particular reason. I'd be happy to provide that as well. It's not one of the best performing rides, as you know, and it's certainly costly, but there's, I think, a lot of reasons for that that are debatable in terms of where it ends and where it begins, as opposed to if the line would have gone to St. Cloud. And so happy to share that information with you, though.
BNSF operations.
Yeah, right.
All right.
So, Mr. Chair, Dunick. So you're saying that, you know, right now St. Cloud does provide express bus service and has a significant amount of ridership, including from St. Cloud State. So you're saying that the current, and if we could certainly monitor how much that bus express is, are you saying that there would be additional ridership beyond the bus service that's currently being provided?
Chair Dunick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I wasn't present when that was passed and moved and when the studies were done, so I'm not certain of how the ridership looks in St. Cloud versus how it is now. I'm not certain.
OK. Okay. And to Mr. Chair, just to show you, this is my Metro pass for D.C. I do use the transit system in D.C. because it's extremely fast. It runs 60 miles an hour between stops, whereas right now our light rail runs at a blazing average speed of about 30. So thank you.
But, Mr. Chair, if I could make a plug.
Chair Dunnick.
We've brought our Green Line time down from about the mid to low 50-minute point-to-point service now down to 45 minutes, and it's much improved thanks to the work of City of St. Paul and Minneapolis to help us with the light synchronization.
Yes, it makes a difference. I noticed that myself riding the Green Line. Anything further, members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you. I just think we owe the bus riders an apology, though, because we're saying that when they're riding the light rail, we don't have to bother. They're nice, and they're going to collect their fares. But when people ride the bus, we can't. And so I just hope that any people out there who might be riding a bus that don't think that we don't think they're nice people, they are nice people. And I don't think that niceness, I think we can be nice and still properly collect fares and do all of those things. So I just was concerned for our bus riders might feel a little put upon it at the comment about the rail
riders. Senator Kiffmeyer, when we institute arterial bus rapid transit on Snelling, for example, the A-line, that'll be off-board expedited fare collection. It'll be similar to how they collect
off-board
fares. Yeah, so similar to the LRT fare collection, what they call off-board. So you pay on the platform before you get on the bus. So we'll think at least the Snelling Avenue bus riders are nice.
Well, maybe we ought to do that at the airport, our parking ramp as well.
So, I don't know. Pretty nice people go to the airport,
too. Trust everybody.
Huh? All right. Anything further, members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
All right.
Discouraged.
Try New York.
No, I haven't. I've been to New York once.
Okay.
Who's the one?
It's different.
No, it's cool.
I'll mention, Madam Chair, as the copies of the Senate File 87A2 amendment are being handed out, that this is also being posted online for folks who prefer to look online. Then looks like everyone likes the paper. For those who have their tablets and want to just pull it up online, it'll be posted if it's not already.
And Senator Dibble, if I can give you the reminder you've given everybody else about the microphone, please.
All right. Thank you. All right.
Senator,
are you ready?
Dibble.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, I'll just start with some preliminary background comments, though Commissioner Zelli and Chair Dunnick already did a nice job of laying out the issues and the proposal that I'm that we're presenting today is not terribly different from their proposal, except there's a few other items in there. Of course, you know, there's been plenty of discussion for many years now about the need to invest in our most basic infrastructure. And we heard all of the metrics around the fact that we have a number of folks that are expected to be moving here. We heard a number of metrics around the upkeep and the status of our infrastructure. We really are looking to do what we can to make sure that Minnesotans can get to their lives both safely and efficiently. We did pass a bill in 2008, and we said at the time that that was probably not even half a loaf. It's a third of a loaf or less. And a lot of those resources are either consumed already via inflation or debt service or We've just spent those dollars or we programmed them for bonding. People, as we know, we had this discussion also about the fact that folks are driving less, both young people and older people. We talked about the greater efficiency in vehicles. It's not so much electric vehicles that we're talking about, but the CAFE standards that are coming at the federal level and the fact that cars are just using a lot less gasoline these days. We expect, like I just mentioned, 800 or so thousand more folks in the next 10 to 15 years. That's going to include 350 to 500,000 jobs. A lot of that new growth in our population is going to be split between the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota. And another point I just wanted to make is that we've really been enjoying the benefit of the effort and the investment in capital and in political effort and sacrifice of previous generations. And we've been enjoying the fruits in terms of the quality of life and our successful economy in Minnesota for a long, long time. And it's time for us now to do what was done for us, both for ourselves and our families, as well as those who come after us. And, of course, the issue doesn't go away. It only becomes more expensive. I've had the opportunity to travel around the state and talk to county engineers and city officials who can just point out, as we stand on the streets and on the roads around the state, the kind of deterioration, the alligatoring, the kind of ingress that starts to seep down, that lets the moisture seep down and deteriorate roadways to the point at which they need to be completely reconstructed, whereas just simply keeping up with them could have done the job. And we also pay, as Commissioner Zelli discussed, in vehicle damage, poor health outcomes, if we're contributing to congestion and pollution, and not allowing for transportation alternatives, worse economic outcomes. The Transportation Finance Advisory Committee report has identified that we just failed to keep up just on our trunk highway system with what we need just to maintain it to the tune of $250,000 per year. That's the $2.5 billion over 10 years that Commissioner Zelli discussed. Half of our roads are greater than 40 years old across the state. 40% of the bridges are greater than 40 years old. We discussed about how 85% of the jobs in the metro area simply aren't easily accessed through a half-hour commute or less. So what we would propose to do in the metro area would give us an ability to accelerate the transit system build-out, create opportunities in all of our communities for pedestrian and biking alternatives, address the repair needs that we have, add to some capacity. The powerful tool of corridors of commerce has shown how much potential is locked up across Minnesota, with companies and commodity groups just waiting for those investments in the roads so they can make expansions or relocations and take pressure off the property taxes. So that's enough background. We've had this discussion quite a bit in this committee and in the hearings in which we across the state in which we heard from Ms. Sobotka. How many folks do we count up testified at the various hearings, 120 or so?
Mr. Chair, 121.
121 folks who came forward to testify. Some with a different point of view, but nevertheless, everyone talking about the need to invest in transportation. No one disagreed with that basic premise, and so I appreciate what Minnesotans are saying to us from across the state, even if they have a different perspective. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I'll try to do a high-level overview of the bill. Not necessarily a formal walkthrough page by page, but if you do need to know exactly what page I'm referring to, we can find it. Council, I'll ask you to help me in case I miss anything, if I miss a key detail, or if we need to find the spot in the bill to draw members' attention to. So the first piece I'll speak to actually is not on the first page, but it starts in on Article 2. Article 1 gives some authorization for bonding for the corridors of commerce and the Transportation Economic Development Program. But that bonding is made possible through the resources that we raise in the bill. The gross receipts tax, similar to the governor's proposal, 6.5 cents on the price of gas collected at the wholesale level with the same $2.50 floor. And did we hand out the revenue notes? All right. So you can see on the projected receipts table that would be anticipated to raise about $351 million in fiscal year 16, $463 million in fiscal year 17. And then we would also propose to raise license tab fees. The minimum, what we call the minimum that every vehicle would pay would go from $10 to $20, and then the percent that's keyed off the price of the car would be raised to 1.5% over the current 1.25%. And that would raise about $73.5 million in the coming fiscal year and $107 in the following fiscal year. And then for the metropolitan area transit tax, we would actually come up to a full cent in the metro area, similar to our peer regions. So that would be a little bit more than the governor proposes. So we would raise 0.75 cents, and that would raise about $233 million in fiscal year 16 and $366 in fiscal year 17. And then the burning question, of course, Carver and Scott, are they going to come into the county's Transit Improvement Board? The answer is no, they won't. So burning question that I get asked almost every day around here. Those proceeds would be, for the most part, appropriated to the Met Council. Some of those dollars would flow to the county's Transit Improvement Board. The county's Transit Improvement Board would maintain their current quarter cent and use it for all the purposes, for the most part, that they do today. Some of the additional dollars that they would be able to allocate would be used for Robert Street Transitway, some capital needed for some smaller transit projects around the metro area. They would continue to pay for 50% of the existing operating costs for the existing transitways that they've had a hand in developing. They would be responsible for part of the transitway capital contribution for light rail transit and highway bus rapid transit. Then the Met Council would make use of these dollars for the regular route bus system. We would indicate to them that they would have a 4% growth in the bus system annually with these additional resources. The arterial bus rapid transit system, the Snelling bus rapid transit, for example, streetcars, bicycle and pedestrian opportunities. We specifically call out Senator Peterson the need to invest in transit shelters. We make a small grant to the Centers for Transportation Studies for purpose of research, similar to what we do through MnDOT resources for research into transitways and economic opportunities and that sort of thing. Trying to see if I'm forgetting anything there. We do allow for 0.125 cents to be flexed for roadway purposes throughout the metro except for Hennepin County, which would still have the authority to flex those, that 0.125 cents that's raised in the metro, but that would have to be connected directly to transit purposes. And then the motor vehicle lease tax, which also receives a lot of discussion and focus, we would propose. Now, some of this is it's a little awkward to be presenting this at this point because we don't have targets. We have no idea what our general fund target and an ability to appropriate is going to be, but we aspire to eliminating the $32 million that gets kind of scooped off the top and dumped into the general fund for whatever general fund purposes the rest of the legislature sees fit. We would bring that into the transportation funds and divvy it up among all five metro counties, but in a way that brings down the amount in the core counties Right now, how it's allocated is based on a population per population basis. But for that purpose, we would count only 50% of Ramsey County's population and 25% of Hennepin County's population. And then we do have a sheet that shows kind of how that divvies out, which do we distribute that? Maybe we should distribute that. Yeah, why don't we go ahead and do that? Greater Minnesota Transit does not receive an appropriation out of the motor vehicle lease tax. What we would propose to do is identify the gap and simply go to the general fund for Greater Minnesota Transit. Again, a little bit difficult to discuss at this point in policy and without a target. In the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, there is, as folks probably remember, before we allocate the proportions out to the Trunk Highway Fund, you know, and the county state aid and the municipal state aid, 5% is taken off the top, and that's put in a what we call a set aside. And presently, we use the set aside for funding town roads and bridges, and then another portion for which we call the flex fund that the commissioner can kind of use for whatever he sees fit, but typically uses it to fund county turnback expenses. So we would propose to take that, the effort that we go to for county turnback funding, you know, when we need to rehabilitate trunk highway facilities before they get conveyed to counties and become county part of the county system, we would create a new account in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund elsewhere and fund that on an annual basis through an appropriation biennial budget process. And we would take and use what we use now for that purpose, similar to how we get dollars to towns, to townships. We would try to get those. We would get those dollars over to cities, both cities above 5,000 and cities below 5,000. One of several efforts that we make on behalf of cities, because the bill as introduced was very deficient in responding to municipal needs. And on that subject, we do create additional resources through various transaction fees, a surcharge on motor vehicle transfers, a $3 motor vehicle transfer fee is redirected from the general fund to a city streets account, and other vehicle fees are redirected from the general fund, and we create a surcharge. Council can, when we get to questions, we can go into more details around that. We create we fund two separate accounts through those resources: a small cities account and a cities of 5,000 and above account, recognizing that we need to try to get dollars to both kinds of cities. We also take the governor's proposal on railroads for the purpose of funding railroad safety and congestion improvements, both on the commercial industrial personal property tax as well as the assessments, and try to get something done on some of these issues that have been fairly alarming to a number of folks. Council, am I forgetting anything on the funding and resource side? Going to jump over to some of the policy items, which do relate back to some of the finance pieces, but we have some just straight up policy items to go through as well. We're good? All right, great. So starting with Article 7, which starts on page 35, we have what's called an efficiency article with a few items. I'll go through those fairly quickly. Some of these are proposals in the governor's bill. We would allow MnDOT to retain the proceeds for software that they develop and they sell, and I can't remember what they would use those proceeds for, but it seemed to make sense if they do that, go to that effort and create a great software, and other people are interested in buying it and they sell it, they can retain it. It goes to the Trunk Highway Fund, so I guess that answers that question. We create a loan fund for right-of-way acquisition. This is something we've discussed in the past, similar to the to the RALF program that we have in the metro area. So it allows for the expedition of right-of-way acquisition through a loan fund in case a unit of government needs to move pretty quickly on an opportunity. We allow MnDOT to retain the proceeds or we give them the authority to use the proceeds from the sale of excess MnDOT property for the purpose of funding a new department at MnDOT. Apparently, the reason and the rationale for that is that there's quite a bit of this that needs to be done, and they need to establish some folks who are dedicated and focused on getting that work.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, you're doing pretty well, but sometimes you seem to trail off a little on this microphone.
I think I'm moving my head away.
Work to just
all right, very good.
Get really close, it would be helpful.
Great, thank you. So that that's section 4 on page 38. MnDOT can use the funds for the sale of land, of excess land, for the purpose of funding some personnel to really carry out that service and that activity. There is a penalty for the late payment of license tab fees. A number of other states do this. We do not. That's an initiative that's been before this committee previously. So the penalty would be $100, $25, but does not exceed $100. Presently, people can just simply pay late. Of course, they're subject to a ticket if they get caught. I've been caught. We have the Federal Fund Flexibility Program that has also been in front of this committee before, but that allows when the opportunities come up in terms of cash flow to swap out state funds for federal funds and vice versa in order to expedite projects and not wait for specific streams of fund to fall into place. Thought to be an efficiency measure in the form of time savings. We allow the Department of Public Safety to determine what the fee should be for escort services and change so that it recovers their actual costs, and the commissioner can make that determination in July of each year. We create a loan fund for the acquisition of transitway right-of-way, similar to the loan fund that I described earlier. This is actually just an addition as the addition of transit as an eligible acquisition in the existing RALF right-of-way loan fund that we have in the metropolitan area. We have on the subject of efficiencies, we have in section 12 on page 44 a direction to the commissioner to identify all of those efficiencies that were developed as a function of the law that we passed in 2008. The Transportation Strategic Management and Operations Advisory Task Force came up with a number of good ideas, and we direct the commissioner to and the commissioner already has, but we re-emphasize to the commissioner to take a look at all of those recommendations and incorporate greater planning for efficiency as that report calls for. And then we just have a simple appropriation that funds the state right-of-way acquisition loan fund that's authorized earlier. Then in Article 8, we have other, we just continue on with other policy initiatives. There are several, I think three, actually I think five various road projects and initiatives, and maybe council can help identify what they all are in the various sections. But we simply expand the eligibility and selection criteria to include safety for all users, economic vitality, some livability elements as well as things like the corridors of commerce, the transportation, economic development, local roads. Council.
Mr. Chair, there are changes to the corridors of commerce program, the TED program, and the local road improvement fund, and one or two of the accounts under it. And the basic idea is for corridors of commerce to expand eligibility to projects that are in cities, that also for Main Street improvement projects. And there, as far as the local road improvement fund, that grants have to provide for increased safety for all road users. And then the TED program was amended to refer to the deed commissioner's performance measures, and also as to consider access to jobs and connections between transportation modes. So it's basically trying to broaden eligibility and broaden the benefits of these programs.
Thank you. And then moving on, at MnDOT's request, we would propose a reinstatement fee of $100 for anyone who's failed to pay and as a result has had their international fuel tax agreement license revoked, their IFTA. So that's the interoperability of you know, how we go about reconciling gas taxes paid, you know, across state lines. In the commercial sector. And then, Council, can you help me remember Section 5, the repeat offenses at the texting?
Yes.
All right. So anyone who commits a second or subsequent violation of the texting violation would pay a $50 fine. Right now, there's no recognition of subsequent violations of texting as a second or greater violation. Where am I? We did a nice job on a few years ago on trying to remedy some of the challenges that we had in the DBE arena, and we've heard some reports from the Office of Civil Rights on the improvements that they've made. And we asked for a report, and we did get one report one time. We ask that we continue to receive reports on how well the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program is working, just as a way of keeping track of and monitoring the effort in that arena as a in response to our oversight responsibility as a legislature. In Section 8, similar initiative to, or one of the initiatives we described on the road programs project eligibility section criteria expansion. Section 9, this is something we discussed with Senator Peterson's leadership, developing active transportation programs, establishing those, creating accounts to receive resources, and establishing potential sources for those funds, and competitive grant process and criteria for making those grants to communities. Section 11 is another one of the expansions of eligibility criteria for our roadway programs. Section 13 relates back to the railroad company assessment issue and establishes a fund for the purpose of those dollars. And in Section 14, Council, can you help me remember? I'm getting confused if this is the airport.
Mr. Chair, it's an amendment. Thank you.
This is having to do with the rail safety.
It's an amendment to the rail service improvement account to the list of purposes to which that money can be put to include safety and capacity at yards.
And then Section 15 is another part of the Senator Peterson's initiative in which we would propose to tax the sale of bicycles for the purpose of making these active transportation improvement programs bike and ped facilities across the state. And then in Section 16, we would propose, this is a MnDOT initiative, to increase the state contribution for local airports. The challenge has as we've probably discussed, I believe, certainly Senator Reinert is aware, a lot of the local units of government simply can't make the level of match that's required in order to qualify for the dollars we have in the airport improvement funds. So they have to forego participating in that program. So we'd bring up the level of state match. We would require, this has been before us, we've had a lot of discussion, we require the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee to work with the Metropolitan Council when they're procuring transit vehicles to make sure that they're suitable for the needs of the disabilities community. Section 18, another initiative on behalf of local units of government. We hear a lot from MSA cities and counties and you know, every local unit of government. When state projects come through, there's a local cost share participation requirement that often absorbs all the resources they might get from the state, and it might even eat into the existing resources that they generate locally. And so their ability to get to their regular road program for the facilities that they're solely responsible for is severely diminished. We have a public-private partnership pilot program, which is fairly lengthy, but we've had a hearing on that in the past. This is work that Senator Peterson and I have worked on together, and so that language is intact with the exception of calling out specific projects that would be eligible for the pilot phase of this initiative. And then Section 20, work that has been championed by Senator Senjum and Senator Jensen, the transportation project selection process, making that process much more collaborative, much more transparent, establishing some factors in the analysis, some additional requirements around collaboration and communicating projects that are selected and the rationale for their selection. Section 21 is a continuation of some of the active transportation work, and that establishes a process by which the agency would develop the criteria and the program parameters and the selection criteria and the like. Section 22 is our ongoing effort to understand better the leakage that goes out of the Trunk Highway Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. It seems like we discover from time to time takes on that money, uses that don't seem to be actually supported by the requirements of the Constitution. So, and or just the opportunity to maybe make a different decision about how we pay for certain things that might not be specifically or explicitly or apparently road and street related. And then Section 23 is the bill that we heard from Senator Schmidt, which would make the design standards for trunk highways consistent with the same design standards that we have for county state aid and municipal state aid roads. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, a great deal of work has gone into this by you and staff and many others. So
thank you. Let me just say one quick thing, a couple quick things, if I haven't been clear yet. We'll lay this on the table after we have our opportunity for discussion, and then take it up again on Friday for some testimony and then any amendments that committee members would like to offer to make the bill even better. And then also it's kind of a little bit of a work in progress, only because this will also be the vehicle by which we do our just standard finance bill. So a number of the appropriations that we would make as a matter of course to fund all of the regular activities of the agencies will also come in this bill. But when this bill comes back, in assuming it gets out of here today or Friday, we'll see, we'll take some of the more routine matters up in finance. And that's also an opportunity where we'll have the chance to take up some additional initiatives that are general fund appropriations and the like that the governor has proposed. Like we don't have the airplane purchase in here, for example. I'm not saying we've made a decision about that, but some of those elements that are in the governor's proposal aren't picked up in here because those are matters for appropriation that we would discuss in finance.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, in just this is a request. In the future, on the finance sheets, we're currently only showing upcoming biennium and then the tails. Can we have, I know some of the new taxes are new taxes. Can we have this current biennium added here so we can see a view from 13, 14, 15, 16 going all the way across?
Yeah, that's a good request. And, Council, can we do that?
Sure.
All right. Yes, thank you.
Westhagen.
Appreciate the request.
Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, just on process. So the anticipation would be to move this in meeting the first policy deadline. If there's bills that we have that might be either up, might have been heard or maybe have met a House deadline, do you anticipate bringing this back such that next week we will potentially hear other bills that we haven't heard but have met the House deadline? And what I'm trying to figure out is what's the best process for offering amendments to bills that might be on a hearing for next week in front of our committee. If this is our omnibus bill Friday and we're done with it, then it kind of creates a bifurcated system.
Right.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, if you have a bill that has met House deadline, I would say that we can deal with it next week. If you have a bill that has not and you're feeling desperate and you want to find a way to keep it alive, I would encourage you to offer it as an amendment on Friday.
And Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, to follow up on the process a little bit, I know we'd had some notes sent in regard to the upcoming schedule for the days. But it does sound like to me you would be expecting amendments on the entire bill relating to some of the revenue aspects as well as policy. And I was thinking that was a little contrary to what we'd gotten in terms of our correspondence, that you were looking for just amendments just on the policy with the finance coming later.
Right.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Kent. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I would say that we're trying to figure that out ourselves because there's a significant policy section. We wanted to be sure that we got things buttoned up in policy this week, just to make sure that our noses were super clean on the policy matters. This bill will come back in finance. There will be opportunity to make finance amendments there, but if you want to offer finance proposals on Friday, you're free to do that as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, is this a day for asking questions to clarify?
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Okay, on page 41. There's a pretty significant policy change that I don't know that we've heard that bill or anything, and this is loans for acquisition that is was previously just for highway, and now it's including and transit projects, and these are no-interest loans. And I know current law has the same policy for highway, but now it's being expanded to transit-related construction as well as transit. That's a large dollar amount to forego interest.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer. So this would be, loans, of course, from the Metropolitan Council. Similar, we have the existing right-of-way acquisition loan fund for roadway purposes, and so what this would propose to do, and this is actually an initiative that comes out of the Met Council, so maybe someone can help me explain it a little bit better. So this is expanding the eligible uses for, if for example, a right-of-way needs to be acquired for a transit purpose, and there's a cash flow issue, and it's a transit project. So I don't know how much we would be foregoing interest, and I frankly don't know how common it is when we make these sorts of government to government. It's more of a cash flow sort of a mechanism, so that if there are resources at the Met Council, another unit needs to acquire some property for some improvements that are related to a transit purpose, they can do so sooner rather than later, and sometimes that helps a lot, because that helps with the inflation factor, the land value increase factor, that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Dibble. Well, it does, and I can understand why somebody would want that. But again, economic development in my city, we have land purchased for economic development that's still sitting there bare. And so you take a huge risk when you're doing loans for, here it says, to accelerate the acquisition of primarily undeveloped property when there is a reasonable probability that the property will increase in value before highway or transit-related construction. And so I'm taking a look at this, and this is, I think, a significant difference from a highway situation where you may purchase some extra right-of-way and it's hard to tell for sure just how much. But this is going into, I think, a very different area. So I have a little bit better understanding. I didn't want to take your time here, Mr. Chairman, when you may have other things on the agenda to clarify.
Senator Dibble.
It's a great question. I appreciate it. If memory serves, and maybe council can confirm, I believe this was in the bill that we passed 2 years ago.
That's correct.
It never made it into law, of course. The House never took the bill up. But the bill that we passed on the floor of the Senate had this provision in it.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, we hadn't heard it this year, but in a previous time.
Correct. Yeah, in the previous biennium.
Okay. Didn't know we could do that.
Additional questions, members?
And I just also want to be clear, this is a lot to absorb. Suzanne doesn't know this. Ms. Sobotka doesn't know this. But, we certainly can take time for more questions on Friday, because this is it's a big bill with a lot in it. And so I don't want to foreclose the opportunity for clarifying questions today. After today, I mean.
An easy crowd today. All right. With that, then, our next meeting will be on Thursday at 5:30, right here in room 15.
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, if we're near to finished, I just had an announcement. I probably should have made it on the floor today, but for anyone interested, from 9:30 to 11 tomorrow in room 546 of the State Office Building, there will be representatives of a group that is proposing to build and operate privately a high-speed rail between Rochester and the Twin Cities. And anybody's there to come, welcome to come, rather, and ask any questions that you might have about that proposal. And that is about as much as I know about it, but it's a big deal if it ever does happen, and there's a proposed private group that wants it to happen.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Would you please repeat the time and location?
9:30 to 11 in room 546. People can come and go. So you're all welcome.
Very good. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, seeing no other questions, meeting is adjourned.